All right, are we talking about editors today? Is that the plan?
Yeah, editors and IDEs.
Right. My plan is to subvert the conversation every chance I get.
So awesome. So today the role of David Brady will be played by Josh Susser?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 40 of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have a guest rogue. It's Gary Bernhardt from Destroy All Software.
Woo!
Yay!
Hooray!
Gary, you want to introduce yourself since you haven't been on the show before?
I suppose I could do that. I run Destroy All Software, like you said. I think I'm mostly known for using Unix and Vim and, to some extent, TDD very quickly. So I guess I'm appropriate for the topic at hand.
All right. Also on our panel, we have Josh Susser.
Hello, good morning. Today I'll be playing the part of David Brady.
That's kind of scary.
Just you wait.
Also on our panel, we have David Brady.
Hey, Control U 4 Alt X involve David Brady.
I feel better already.
That's an Emacs joke. And that's why I can't play the part of David Brady. I've got a dog in this fight. Let's go.
So David will be playing the part of Josh Susser. Also on our panel, we have Avdi Grimm.
Good morning. I'm Avdi, and today I will be representing the WordStar editor.
We also
it's too early in 2004.
We also have James Edward Gray on the podcast.
Hey, everybody. I'm participating in this call via Emacs' Skype mode.
How do you do that? Control, I don't even know, control chat. Anyway, I'm Charles Max Wood from teachmetocode.com, and as you can tell, we're going to be talking about text editors and IDEs today. So we've kind of had some discussion, some friendly banter back and forth about Emacs and Vim and, you know, some of the other IDEs out there. And so we thought we would get in and talk about it. Gary's done
Wait. Control chat? You hold down control and then push the chat key?
Yeah, don't you have one?
Only Indian keyboards have that.
I want this! Do I have to learn Sanskrit? Because I will.
Please don't encourage him.
Oh, you can take the David Brady out of David. You can put the David Brady into Josh Susser, but you... Oh, that's kind of awkward. But you can't take the David Brady out of David Brady. That's the important thing.
Get out of my head, David.
Yeah, I'm in your head. I'm in your head messing with your thoughts.
All right. So, really quickly, I'm a little curious as to who uses what primarily. So let's go around the panel real quick and just see what you use for most of your programming. James, what do you use?
So I use TextMate primarily. That's probably not too shocking since I wrote a book on it. Lately, I have been teaching myself Emacs, and I will admit that it's growing on me, and I have enjoyed working with it, and maybe I'm using it some now, and maybe someday I might even switch.
James, none of us want to hear about what's growing on you.
That's a good point.
Avdi, what are you using?
I use primarily Emacs.
All right. David?
Emacs forever, man.
Gary?
I only use TextMate, actually. I think that, not to get this started too early, but this whole Vim thing is so ridiculous. Did you know that editor, the way it was designed with the whole modal thing was because they had 300 baud modems? And it's like, I just can't even stand it. I need something pretty, and I need something that requires me to click my mouse as many times as possible. So I use TextMate exclusively.
Let the trolling begin.
Clicky, clicky. All right.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I missed something.
Somebody's got his Josh. Game face on.
Yeah. And if you believed that.
Josh, what are you using?
BB Edit Forever. No.
Yes.
Because it doesn't suck. No. Yes. No, I used to love BB Edit, and then TextMate came out. Yeah, TextMate crushed BB Edits for me. And TextMate is still my go-to text editor. I've been using RubyMine a lot lately, as I said on the Pix last week, which is kind of nice as an IDE. But I still like TextMate for the pure character manipulation power.
All right.
And I have to disclaim that while I can type a few things in VI, I haven't used Emacs since it was written in Tico.
Yikes.
All right. Nice reference, sir.
Tico, isn't that the URL shortener for Twitter? Tico.
Nice.
Yeah. Very good, nice. Sir.
Also written in Emacs, by the way.
Yeah, because Emacs is a language and an editor.
Emacs is an operating system unto itself. In fact, it would be a complete, finished, robust operating system. All it lacks is a good text editor.
All right. Well, I'll chime in. I actually use Vim. I think I've said that on the podcast before, so no shock there, right?
So you have a slow modem?
It's plugged into the back of my head.
Oh, guys, I was worried that this wouldn't be a very good episode.
Just wait. We've only just gotten started.
We've only just begun.
We haven't started throwing stones yet.
So should we talk about the IDE versus text editor thing?
Yeah, let's go into that first, and then we can all fight over which text editor is better.
Well, I think Gary already settled it, really.
We can spend the rest of the episode drinking.
So, Josh, normally we turn to you for a definition. Could you please give us the rules for the drinking game?
Yes. Every time you have to type a regular expression to find a file by name, you have to drink.
Oh, jeez.
So, Josh, since you do love definitions, how about IDE versus text editor?
Okay, so an IDE is an integrated development environment, and I've been using that TLA since 1984. The first IDE I ever ran across was Smalltalk, and I think that was really one of the first IDEs around, if not the, although maybe Lisp beat Smalltalk to it. An IDE is basically soup to nuts of everything you do programming in one place. You know, you edit the text, you have the ability to compile and run tests, and you know, all that good stuff all in one place, debugging. So Smalltalk had a kind of crappy text editor, but the IDE features made programming in Smalltalk, you know, great and really productive. So the other side is text editors, where the focus is, hey, we're editing files. Our program consists of a bunch of files in a file system, and let's go edit those things. So I can't come up with a better definition than that.
Did Lisp actually have an IDE, or did it have a TIATI, a TIATI, which is basically you fire up the REPL and this is all there is?
Yeah, actually, the InnerLispD IDE that ran on Xerox machines in the 80s was pretty freaking awesome.
Really?
Yeah. It was basically everything that you could do in the Smalltalk environment. They had the equivalent in the Lisp environment, and actually the two teams stole liberally from each other. So there's,
Josh, I am so jealous of you. It's you and I are about the same age, and yet you had like a productive childhood.
You had way more fun than all of us.
I was gonna say. I remember the 80s. Elementary school was really fun. Yeah,
yeah. Okay, moving right along.
So one of the differences that's always separated editors from IDEs, and I think this is actually less true these days, is it used to be like you guys are talking about, there was a Smalltalk IDE, which is actually kind of Smalltalk itself, and a Lisp IDE. And the thing about IDEs is that traditionally they were very bound to a single programming language. And it's getting to be less that way. I mean, now, you know, you have RubyMine, but you have, you know, the JetBrains IDE supporting multiple languages. You have Eclipse supporting multiple languages. But that was actually one of the things that turned me off to IDEs in the first place is it used to be, you know, you'd go into a big programming shop and you'd go into a particular team and it'd be like, okay, we're using this language, so we're all using this IDE. And, you know, you'd spend 6 months or a year programming on that and learning it and maybe adding some extensions to it and stuff like that. And then you'd move to another team. It's like, okay, we all use this IDE here, which is, you know, a completely different environment. And so you'd lose everything. And that was considered completely normal.
Yeah. So that's a great point, but I guess I need to amend my definition of IDE then. An IDE is a crutch for people using Java so that the language is usable.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yes. It's like for languages with very high ceremony, the IDE is like a portable cathedral.
Yeah. Well, the other thing you have to bring up with IDEs is you know, the classic chapter in Pragmatic Programmer, Evil Wizards, because that's always been kind of identified with IDEs, is the idea that it's something that will generate a lot of code for you. And that's not necessarily tied to an IDE, but sort of it sort of traditionally is, you know, the idea of something that will generate magic code for you that you don't need to think about. You just need to not touch it and it'll work.
Right. Well, one thing that I've seen with a lot of the IDEs, because I've talked to people that swear by their IDE, you know, be it RubyMine, or I know a few people who used to use NetBeans when it supported Ruby and things like that.
I know a lot of people who swear at their IDEs.
you must have been sitting near me when I used one. Anyway, a lot of times what they tout are things like auto-completion. You know, sometimes it'll parse their code and you know, it picks up errors and things like that. The other thing that I've heard people talk about is like the built-in debuggers. And
refactorings.
Right. And, yeah, refactorings and some of these other tools that are built into it. And I have yet to find anything that the IDE will do that I can't do from either Vim with specific plugins or the command line.
Yep. Yeah, like go to a symbols definition or go to a methods definition. Oh, look, if you run C tags, you can do that with any text editor.
Right. And so it's kind of an interesting discussion. The thing that drives me crazy with the IDEs is that I have yet to find one that doesn't bog down my computer when I run it. Whereas with the text editors, they're usually a little more lightweight and they run on, you know, I can run everything else from the command line and my machine is still snappy. It still responds. So. So
that depends on how large a file you're trying to open in TextMate.
That's very true. Yeah.
Yeah, TextMate.
Yeah. So I actually started with the granddaddy of them all, which was Developer Studio. Josh, to give a nod to your point, I've actually in job interviews had questions like, which key do you press to compile your code? I mean, literally interview questions were like, do you know Developer Studio? You know, forget about the language. Do you know the tool? And I was hip deep in Developer Studio when the Pragmatic Programmer came out, and they had that line about know your editor, and I'm like, all right, let's get out the plasma torch and the screwdriver. I'm going to rip the face off this thing. And I wrote my own wizards for Developer Studio. I compiled my own plugins for it that I would distribute to the team that would put up little, you know, it would add little buttons to Developer Studio that they could click that would run things. I integrated basically our own version of Make using Python and then bolted it into Developer Studio for the team to use. I loved Developer Studio, man. I had that thing singing and dancing and doing backflips for me. And then the whole open source revolution came along, and I threw it all out to switch to Vim and then to Emacs. And I think that's why I bounced off of Vim and right into Emacs was because, and we'll get into this when we start talking about the philosophy of Vim versus Emacs. But I'd come from this environment where the tool did everything, and anything that the tool couldn't do, you could embed it in the tool and it would subsume it and it would become part of it was Borg. We are Borg. We will assimilate all your tools. And I went to Vim, and Vim does nothing, and it does it very fast, and it does it very efficiently, and if you want to do anything else, go somewhere else, right? And then I went to Emacs, and they're like, welcome home, child. We can subsume everything. We've got a web browser right here in the text editor. Let's go.
So I think that's actually kind of an interesting point, though. Like, people's usage of text editors seems to vary quite a bit. Like, I know some people who they program, they never use any shortcuts, you know, like that, like you know, that are built into the editor. My example is, do you type end in Ruby? End. I never type end, period. Mm-hmm. You know, and some people do. They always type end, you know.
I type do, and then I type tab or enter.
Right.
And Emacs goes, hey, you need an end here. There it is.
Right, exactly. What were you going to say, Gary?
I've typed every single end that has ever gone into any Ruby code I wrote.
So see, there's very different, you know, ways that people use the editor.
Yeah. James, you're saying that you wouldn't need that level of power in your editor if you programmed in Python?
I guess that's true, yeah.
Yeah, because back to Dave's point, you type tab.
Go ahead.
An editor is a device which makes programming in Ruby bearable by putting in all of that you know, voluminous boilerplate.
Although, as we're about to see when Gary and I actually get into it, an editor is a tool that makes other programmers insufferable.
What I was going to say is that and then there's other people like me and Dave, who really, Adam Keyes described it, my favorite description of preparing your editor's like configuration is kind of like crafting your own lightsaber. And then, you know, we want to have it exactly the way we want it. And I want to know that I type those three keys and this series of steps happens, you know, and we like the editor to be like a extension of ourselves, you know, where we train it the way we like to work and move that way.
Absolutely. I don't want to put words in Gary's mouth, but I feel like the Vim philosophy is it's a toolbox. You should be able to throw it in the back of your pickup truck, and it's a standard toolbox. If you rode to work with Carlos today and you get out, you grab his toolbox, and it should be the same tools, everything where you expect it. You move to a different machine, and there it is. And Emacs is not like that. Emacs is like a workshop. And when you move to a new house, you have to set up your workshop because you want the table saw over here, you want the drill press over here. And, you know, I'll admit it, I don't just have a .emacs file. I have a .emacs directory, and it's got half a megabyte. Right? It's got half a megabyte of crap in there and all kinds of third-party packages and crap. Yeah.
I'm not sure that I like that analogy very much. I think Vim is really, it's more of a chainsaw. And the last thing you want on a chainsaw is controls that are not the controls you're used to, because then you will cut your hand off.
Right, right.
And Emacs is more like a chainsaw that has other little chainsaws inside of it, and it just shoots them in random directions all the time. So it doesn't matter if you change the controls, because you're going to get your hand cut off anyway.
Well, not your hand. Maybe like your half a leg. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Gary, you recently did on Destroy All Software, which I know we've mentioned several times on the show, you recently did an episode where you, being the VI user, kind of went back and showed some Emacs and said, you know, I used to be an Emacs user. These are the reasons why I used Emacs. And then these are the reasons why I switched to Vim and prefer it. I found that episode very, very cool.
Me too.
Could you maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, why on both sides?
Yeah. Basically, I think that Emacs is an absolutely crap editor, having used it for several years. But it is a really good programming environment. It has everything in it, and when you get down into programming it is so nice, and Vim is so awful to program. Like save excursion is the only word I need to say to make the difference clear.
You should probably explain what that does, though.
I don't know if I can. Save excursion is like you're writing a script in Emacs and you want it to manipulate the buffer in some way. So you say save excursion and then you do a bunch of editing commands in your code, in your Lisp code. And when the save excursion is done, everything is back the way it was before you did those commands. So it's like a Git stash or something for your editing. In Vim, you do all of that manually, and it's so tedious and awful. And that is a wonderful like microcosm of the difference between the two editors right there. Is Emacs has all these nice things in it, and Vim is just like a chainsaw, really, and it is your problem to take care of everything.
Yeah, I would say, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, I use Vim a little, but I'm definitely not an expert, but I would say that people tend to favor Vim for the out-of-box experience, that, like, the way Vim is with its modes and moving around in it and stuff, they like that, and they like it in that they'll go to another server and it'll be the same out-of-the-box experience on that server, and it'll work pretty well. And where Vim kind of hurts is the whole Vim script thing. I mean, like, right? It's like, why, you know, if you wanted to customize your editor, you know, seriously, would you rather learn Vim script or Lisp, you know, kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I mean, even an Emacs user, if he's serious about Unix, knows Vim, because he's going to SSH into a server eventually.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Right.
I'm just going to come out here as the token Emacs guy on the group.
Hey.
You have to, oh, I'm sorry.
We'll give you a token too, Audie. You can play later.
I'm the token Emacs guy. You're the actual Emacs character who has, you know, a character arc in the story.
Yeah, but he doesn't have a Lisp.
Sorry. So, no, you have to know Vim. You have to. I mean, it's not optional. And I would disagree, though, that was actually one of the things for me, picking up a blank editor, I'd rather pick up a blank Emacs than pick up a blank Vim. And I can sum it up in one word: no HL search.
HL search. Can you explain that?
When you search for something in vanilla Vim, it highlights everywhere in the file the thing you're searching for. You search for the, you know, THE, and it lights up all through the file. And then you're done searching, so you go back into command mode or into normal mode or whatever, the non-edit visual mode, whatever. I don't know, the modes, whatever, you kids. Anyway, you're done searching, and it stays highlighted. You can start typing and you can go into insert mode and start working, and it stays highlighted. It won't stop being highlighted. And the hilarious thing is half of the novice Vim users out there don't know how to turn it off. And so I have seen three different Vim users do this. They just get in the habit of searching for herp, you know, herp,
yep,
derp.
Yep.
just because it doesn't appear in the document. And it makes, now I'm searching for something that doesn't exist. And that has the effect of turning off the highlighting.
But no, I have HL search on, but I have return remapped to clear the search.
I was going to ask you about that, because I've seen that in the destroy all screens or destroy all software, where, like, you'll do something and I see this mapped to no HL search, and I'm like, ooh, that's a friendly thing.
Yep. It's unfortunate.
So there, what about, you know, I think Gary doesn't consider TextMate and the other similar editors, you know, as serious, but I will say that, you know, there's a lot of popularity in TextMate now and maybe waning in TextMate and growing in things like Sublime Text 2.
Sublime Text.
Right. And these are, you know, more GUI-centric editors, but it's interesting some of the old things they bring to the table. For example, TextMate has, you know, is very Emacs-ish in the way it does a lot of things. And I would say one of the major advantages to TextMate is you can basically script the damn thing in Ruby, right? Which is great. You know, it's one of the reasons I fell in love with it. With Sublime Text 2, I've only looked at very briefly, so I'm not great at speaking to this. But, you know, I know that it has, like, a vintage mode and stuff, so it's bringing in, like, Vim stuff, you know, in some ways, and many of its own features and stuff. But what do we think about, you know, more like the modern era of editors?
So my take on this, really, I use Vim, so, and I used to use TextMate. TextMate used to be my primary use thing. The problem that I always had and that kept driving me back to Vim, and I actually tried Emacs for a while. Dave was teaching it to me when we were working together. I started out as a systems administrator, and I got really used to the power of just being able to use the keyboard and not have to mess around with the mouse too much, because it for me, it feels like a context switch to go back and forth. And so, you know, using a text editor like Vim or Emacs where I can do everything from a keyboard versus something like TextMate or Sublime Text where, you know, you wind up interacting with the GUI and using the mouse and stuff, it felt like I could get more done doing it the other way. But that being said, there are some powerful features to TextMate that I really did like, so...
You know, that argument always surprises me, and maybe it's just because I'm the guy that wrote a book about TextMate, but I use TextMate pretty much all day, every day, and I never touch a mouse, so I don't know if we just don't do a good job of, like, showing how to use TextMate keyboard-driven or what, but that's an interesting thing.
Well, I think there are two things there. I think one is, yeah, I don't know... I mean, unless people go out and, like, buy your book or something, that people really know that. But I don't think it's part of the culture either of the people that use TextMate, where, you know, Vim and Emacs are much more about customizing it so that you can get the work done, you know, in a certain way.
I'm going to go ahead and shill for James here and say if you don't own the TextMate book and you use TextMate, you're an idiot. Because James's book does exactly that. I mean, he gets into, I mentioned last week's episode that I have it bookmarked. I have my copy bookmarked to the page that shows you like the Command F, Command Shift G for, you know, find next, replace, you know, replace and find next, and, you know, all the find and replace commands in TextMate. And, you know, my editing philosophy is when in Rome, speak Italian. And, unless you're an ancient Roman, then speak Latin. But anyway, if I'm editing pair programming on a Mac with somebody who is fluent in TextMate, we use TextMate. And if I'm doing my own stuff, I use Emacs. And if I'm shelled into a server and I need to edit a comp file really quickly, I use Vim. And there's a lot to be said for knowing, having a passing fluency in a lot of editors, because it helps you communicate and work with other people.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true. You know, David talks about the, you know, the shortcuts in TextMate for like finding text and stuff. And that's another reason why I actually kind of like it. And one of the things that does bug me about Sublime Text too, TextMate adopts the normal Mac conventions. So what David just said, you know, Apple F to find, Apple G to find again, that works in basically every single Mac program. And that's awesome because you just learn it once and then use it everywhere, you know? Whereas Sublime Text has its own shortcuts for everything, and that kind of bugs me because then when I go there, it's not the same thing, you know?
I think that's really important, and that's one of the reasons why I resisted using RubyMine for years. Was it RubyMine, you can set up all the key bindings whatever way you want, and all of the RubyMine set up at Pivotal when I started working there were all configured for people who are used to working on Unix and Windows, and I couldn't type the regular Mac keys. It's like home, that took you to the beginning of the line. It's like, why would home do that, right?
I'm kind of the opposite. For me, the editor commands are more important than the operating system commands. And the editor commands are the ones I want to stay consistent. I don't care as much about the operating system specific stuff. And I think that reflects the fact that, I mean, I started using Emacs when I was at a Windows shop, and I brought that configuration, you know, and this was part of the reason I started doing it was, you know, I used that configuration on Windows for years. Then I brought those configuration files to my Linux system and, you know, and used that. Then I brought those configuration files to my Mac, you know, and used the same Emacs behavior on the Mac for a couple of years. And then I brought those configuration files back to Linux. And it was the same system that I'd been developing the whole time. And so for me, it was much more important that my development environment stay consistent than that my development environment stay consistent with the operating system that it happened to be hosted in.
Yeah, that's very true. And Emacs, though, you know, you may be running your shell and stuff like that inside of Emacs, right? Though, which then, you know, kind of adds to that consistency, right? That in your shell, in your coding, in your whatever, you are using the same key commands everywhere, wouldn't you say?
Right. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think that's actually almost the same argument made from a different way. That's one of the things Emacs does, in my opinion.
Right. And I mean, people make the joke about Emacs being an operating system, but it's not a joke. I actually take that very seriously. It's not an operating system, but it is an operating environment. It's a desktop environment for programmers. And, you know, and that's, I think that's, if you go to it, that's a big part of the reason that you do, is that you want this, you know, programmers operating environment where things can be consistent across operating systems. And that, you know, assists you in various interesting ways.
So for the record, the official joke there is Emacs is an operating system. Linux is its device driver.
So really quickly, I want to ask, I know that there are different ways of getting started with some of these text editors. For example, when I was learning Emacs, I was using Aquamax. And for Vim on my Mac, I use Mac Vim. If you're getting started with these on Windows or Linux, are there other packages or good ways of getting these particular text editors?
Well, no. real computers come with both installed, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, even if you're using a system that doesn't come with, I mean, obviously any Linux system is going to have some version of VI installed, probably Vim these days. Mm-hmm. Actually, does anybody even use the older versions of VI anymore?
Still Joy, that's all.
Okay. and, you know, and then they're going to have Emacs packaged as part of the standard package repository, so you just say you want to install it.
Yeah. That said, Mac OS X's packaging of Emacs is quite embarrassing. It's like, how many years old? It's very, very old.
Oh, CentOS. Yeah,
22.
Yeah. CentOS takes the cake. CentOS absolutely takes the cake. I was working at a shop last year, a year and a half, with Chuck. You and I were working there together, and they were a CentOS shop. And the packaged RPM version of Emacs was from 2006. It was like Emacs version 20. And I ranted and railed and said, please get me a current version of Emacs. And so he went out there and he found somebody who had built a custom bundle of Emacs. And he says, here you go. And he installed it. And it was like Emacs 22 or 21, a late version of 20. I'm like, dude, we're in Emacs 23 now. Can I please have Emacs 23? And yeah.
And nowadays, I would even recommend going to straight to 24, even though it's the development version, because it includes the packaging system. And to me, that's awesome because, you know, now you can just go into the packaging system and install stuff, you know, without having to do the manual dance for that, which is just crap.
All right, this is kind of a funny story, but the IT guy at that shop was so paranoid and so security-minded that he would not allow C compilers on any of the production machines. And so I would get on one of the develop machines that had a compiler. I would download Emacs, and I would build it and compile it in my home directory. And then I would SCP the whole thing up to the production machine because it was the same kernel. And he found out I was doing this, and so he locked me out of the C compiler on the development machines.
Okay, so one of the things about Emacs is that you should never have to do that. You should never have to put it on a production machine.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But anyway, my solution to it was I went out and got I had VMware Fusion, so I went and I got an ISO of CentOS of the same kernel version and set up a virtual machine with a compiler, built Emacs, and copied it up to the production machine again. And it's developers versus IT, man. The war continues. That should be another episode. DevOps versus...
I've been on both sides, so I'd be interested to talk about it.
So one of the things about Emacs is that you should never have to copy it to your production server or any server, because it has the most mature remote editing system.
Tramp mode
has been in development since something like 1996, and it's very, very mature. Basically, you point it at a server. And has various ways you can specify what server you want it to point it at. And it will go through a series of machinations where it figures out what technique is available to edit things remotely there. If it can shell in, it'll, you know, using SSH, it'll shell in. If it can only, you know, SCP files back and forth, it'll figure that out and it'll start SCPing the, you know, the file up whenever you save it. If it can rsync, it'll rsync, you know, and you can actually watch it as you point it at the server and tell it what remote file you want to edit. You can see it basically trying things out. And if it needs to, it'll install, it'll open up a shell session and install little shell functions in that, you know, that ephemeral shell, just so it has a consistent environment. So it's a really, really mature, remote editing system. And it's really sad when I see people, trying to use Emacs on a remote system, when they could just be using their local Emacs setup.
Yeah. I admit that I am not as fluent in tramp mode as I ought to be. But the few times that I tried it, it was really, really slow. And so it was painful latency. And so I'm like, you know what, if I'm working on your server, give me a recent Emacs.
Yeah, you know, I would think that tramp mode would be that thing that leaves a tattoo on the lower back of your operating system.
Yeah. Yeah. You flip the DVD case over and it's down right below the midriff. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
For the record, I do not believe tramp mode is one of these inadvertently or deliberately rudely named things. I think they're referring to like hobos. Not. Sorry, these things come up in the Ruby community, you know, where it's like these, you know, dubiously named gems, and I don't think it's
You get on. There's an Emacs I'm editing files here, but I am basically Emacs homeless on this server. That really is the whole spirit behind tramp mode. Yeah.
So this kind of goes back to what Chuck asked a bit ago about, you know, is there good ways to get started? And he mentioned some of the like prepackaged systems, which comes with lots of settings. I tend to avoid those because I find that by customizing it, I'm actually learning things about it and stuff like that. I will say that I spent a large chunk of last year finally getting familiar with Vim. And I found that an easier process to get familiar with Vim. And one of the great things in doing that was the Vim Golf site, because you could go in there and it would give you some challenge and ask you to do it in, you know, the fewest number of keystrokes, and then it would record it and put it up there and it would show you where you fell on the list, but you could see the people a little bit below you and a little bit above you and what keystrokes they did, you know? And so then you're like, wait, what does that do? And you go try that and you're like, oh, and you kind of advanced your knowledge step by step, and I found that kind of useful.
Mm-hmm.
Emacs, on the other hand, I find much more frustrating. This year I'm getting familiar with it. As far as like learning things, a lot of the reason is the naming. Emacs does have a lot of the creative naming, you know, like Tramp, and one of the ones I remember recently is Hippie Expand. I was looking for good auto completion and just didn't know how to say that, you know, and it wasn't until I learned that in Emacs good auto completion is called Hippie Expand, you know, and after I learned that, then I knew it. And that also is kind of, Emacs has some pretty stupid defaults in my opinion. For example, it comes with an auto completion command bound to /, I think. But Hippie Expand.
Meta slash.
Is it meta slash? Yeah, you're right. meta slash. But Hippie Expand does all of that and more. For example, it literally calls the default auto completion command as part of what it does, plus other things. So, like, I can't imagine why you would not just replace that binding with Hippie Expand. Mm-hmm. It's that plus a lot better, you know? So it's kind of weird, and I find it more frustrating to learn. I mean, Emacs, I will give you, has, you know, many built-in manuals and stuff. I view it kind of like Skyrim, where you can just load it up and sit there and read books for days. and it's pretty much the same, but it's pretty daunting. I mean, there's basically a manual on how to read manuals in Emacs, you know?
It's not that bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad, right? I mean, control H I info, and then you push T to take a tutorial where it walks you through how to read a book in Emacs, right?
Mm-hmm. It loads up.
Yeah, but it's a really easy system. I mean, you know, you press N to go to the next page. You just press P to go to the previous page. You can press U to go up.
Yeah, it's fairly simple.
Also, like Skyrim, if you're running Emacs, if you're not running the HD texture pack, you're missing out on half of Emacs.
The thing that I do like about it is that it's very, very introspective. So you can ask Emacs about anything, and it can give you an answer. So you can say like apropos, and it'll and expand, and it'll tell you about all the functions and all the variables that it knows about that have the word expand in them. And you can also do things like, you know, you hit a key and it does something and you're not sure what it just did. There are ways of looking at the log of the things you just did, but you can also ask it, what was that key bound to? And it'll send you to the documentation of the function, since everything that you do in Emacs is a Lisp function. It'll send you to the documentation of the function that's bound to the key that you just hit.
I have to agree. Emacs' documentation blows anything else I've seen out of the water. I mean, like, if you're coming from Ruby, where we're famous for our fairly bad documentation, Emacs is almost exactly the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. At any given time, you have one major mode active and several minor modes, typically, and you can just hit a keystroke and Emacs will explain every single mode active in the current window.
Yeah.
And that's very amazing. I mean, if you ask it, what is this variable, it will tell you what that variable is and what its current setting is, you know, so that you can...
And it'll give you a link, if it's possible, it'll give you a link to the page where you can visually adjust the setting of that variable.
Setting, yeah.
Yeah, I will say that's amazing.
So much of Emacs is almost like this really complicated neural net, right? I mean, you're like negotiating with another brain in order to achieve the editing of your files. And so my answer to the question of how do you get started with Emacs is you really need to go hang out in the Emacs channel on freenode.net. And the reason why is because when you hit that moment like James hit where I know kind of what I want, but I have no idea intuitively what it's called. I don't know where to begin looking for, you know, I don't know the name of the thing to search for. I had an indentation problem where I had one file that was indenting four spaces and I wanted it to indent two. And I looked at, you know, C basic offset was set to two and SH indent was set to two. And I could not figure out. And somebody came back and said, well, there's this other indentation variable that's being inherited and masked by the mode that you're in. And it should be set to da 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 da. And I'm like, wow, I never would have found that without somebody who knew what I was looking for already. And the guys in the Emacs channel are really, really newbie friendly.
Cool. Well, I'm going to cut off the Emacs love here and get to the picks.
We have not let Gary talk at all for the last 20 minutes, which is probably safe because we were talking about, you know, the editor of all evil.
That's Gary. Okay. We sound smarter for having had him here.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I do love Emacs. Don't get me wrong. Actually, there's something interesting, which is that, sorry to cut off your cutting off, Chuck. Somebody was talking about how Emacs has, it ships with, what is it? It ships with one type of completion and then there's another type, hippie whatever. And what you're seeing there is the fact that Emacs is older than most or maybe all of us, maybe not D. Brady. And
why? Because it refers to hippies?
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it is a very old system and it has changed. And these two editors have backwards compatibility rules in them, in the communities, that are so strong compared to what we're used to. And in fact, I don't think a lot of people realize this, but Emacs is not on version 24. Emacs is on version 1. That 24 is the minor version. It's Emacs 1.24.
Yeah.
So that tells you just how little they break backwards compatibility.
Yeah. It's because when Richard Stallman tells you to get off my lawn, people get off his lawn.
That is exactly true.
No new features!
So, you know, Vim and Emacs have been, you know, a big focus here, and we've talked about TextMate too a little bit. The big complaints that I often see people making about why are people arguing between Vim and Emacs? They're both like 70s technology. Why are we still using these things as our premier editors? And it seems like both of these things, they're optimized to work in environments where you don't have a bitmap display. All you have is a character level display, and you don't need a very big pipe to talk to them, and you don't need to be dealing with the inconsistencies across operating systems of how mouse events work and crazy things like that. So I think that playing to that lowest common denominator is what makes them ubiquitous, but I think it's also what drives me crazy about trying to use them. I was hoping Gary had something pithy to say about that.
Well, I don't know about pithy, but I do have something to say, which is that even in Vim, in my terminal, I encounter situations where I'm actually CPU bound, just editing text, just moving around. And the idea of using an editor that's much slower than Vim just makes me, I'm already frustrated just thinking about it, because I'm already CPU bound in some situations. So for me, it's all about speed and the fluidity with which I can interact with the text.
That said, I watch Gary edit in Vim all the time, thanks to Destroy All Software, and he is about 5,000 times faster than I am, so I can definitely see why that would bother.
Yeah, I was going to say that nice chip that you have in your computer that has like 8 cores, and each core does like billions of operations a second. Yeah, Gary can outpace those.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also I would add to Gary's answer that the why are we still using these 70s editors to edit text? And the answer is that, okay, yeah, we have these high-res displays, and we have windowing systems, and we have pointing systems, and yet the way we program computers is still by manipulating character streams. And so these old tools for manipulating character streams are the best to do it, because all the fancy editors, all they've really added is high-res displays and windowing systems. They haven't really appreciably readdressed the problem of manipulating character streams.
Yeah, that's, one other thing. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
That's very true. And also, I would add to that that I think that when I'm using Vim, I like the way that text looks better than anything I've ever seen in another editor. Because I'm using, I'm using Enconsolata G 16 point. It's anti-aliased. I have the colors set to exactly the RGB values I want. It can look like whatever you want. And also, Emacs especially has a windowing system that is so much more powerful than whatever GUI editor you want to use. It is night and day. And Vim's is pretty powerful as well. So even those arguments, I think, are just a result of people seeing, oh, it's text. It's not windowing. But window can mean more than one different thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually want to add to that just a tiny bit, because some of my answers to that question, like why use these, archaic text editors as opposed to the big GUI versions, I have learned from watching Gary's Destroy All Software screencast. And one is, I would say, is the tight Unix integration is so good, right? And like, for example, just being able to suspend the app, and then do something in the shell real quick and then foreground it again, just like you would with any other shell app, so it just flows naturally. Or Gary constantly, while he's working, will remap some Vim command to run a certain task that he's doing right now. So he'll just stop and remap a key to run his tests or something, and do that right on the fly. And then, like he was saying with the windowing system, I used to use tmux all the time for basically everything I do in the shell. And as I am getting into Emacs, I'm doing that less and less, because Emacs can split windows, manage frames, all that, so I tend to just have Emacs do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing the reason that I kept coming back to Vim too is that I was a systems administrator for 5 years, mainly managing Linux systems. So the thing is my mental map is Vim. I mean, that's just the way that it works. And, I get Emacs and I get TextMate and I get some of these other things, but you know, ultimately, you know, it fits my workflow better than any of the others do.
Yep.
And, you know, that's fair enough to say about any other text editor. I mean, if it fits your workflow, if it makes you work faster, better, more efficiently, whatever it is, then by all means, you know, use it and figure out how to use the tool to, you know, to further that. I just think it's interesting that, you know, people go and attack this without actually, you know, really understanding, okay, you know, this really fits into this guy's workflow because it provides these right. tools and he interacts with it in this way. And, you know, it provides these different interfaces and it works with the way he thinks. And so, I mean, if an IDE works best for you, then by all means, go for it. You know, if it's Emacs, if it's Vim, if it's TextMate, if it's Sublime Text, if you want to use Notepad on Windows, for heaven's sake, I mean, go ahead.
Yeah. And you know that I actually kind of take issue with that. I think that the idea that a certain tool fits my brain is almost always an excuse for I know this thing and I don't want to take the time to start over. My view of software development tools is, especially old ones like Unixy stuff and Vim and Emacs, is that the guys who are working on this today have been using it probably since before I was born in most cases. And there is a really good reason that they have made these decisions, and I don't understand that reason. And for me to say that doesn't fit my brain because I looked at it for 2 weeks and these guys have been working on it for 30 years, I think that is a tremendously arrogant thing to say. So my approach to Vim, for example, is still to this day, I use very few plugins, and I actually do a very small amount of customization, relatively speaking. My VimRC is long, but that's because there's a bunch of old experiments sitting in it, and it's only like 700 lines. So I don't know. I really think that it's a much better approach to just chill out and accept the thing for what it is and try to learn why it's that way.
Huh. That's interesting. I'm going to have to think about that.
I would I think I can hybridize both of what you said. Because I'm kind of with Chuck, where I want to say Emacs fits my brain, but you're right. It's very arrogant and very curmudgeonly to just say I don't like this other thing because the thing that I have I like it so much. Where I actually spent a year and a half using Vim and moving into it and really understanding it, and then I went over to Emacs, and when I got into Emacs, what I found is I really didn't like mode-based editing. I just didn't care for it. And there's a big difference between saying this isn't for me and saying this is dumb. You know, it's really yeah. easy to say mode-based editing is stupid, or conversely, having to find a control or an alt or a meta or a shift or whatever to edit everything is stupid. No, it's if you have used both and you know both, it's totally fair to say I feel so much more empowered and enabled and engaged when I'm in this method versus the other. And that's somebody that you know, we can party. You know, you can sit down and we can party. Even if you've settled on Vim. So
absolutely. I totally agree. When I said that, I didn't mean the person who spent a year and a half in it. I meant more right. the person who spent a few weeks or even a month or two. That's just not long enough.
The person who failed yeah. his saving throw against changing editors. Yeah.
Right.
And don't be afraid to say that, you know, tool A does most of the job that I want, but tool B actually has some really useful stuff as well. I mean, yeah. I have RubyMine license and I use it from time to time because it has some refactoring stuff in it that isn't in Emacs or that I haven't seen a good package for in Emacs. And if the choice for me is I'm not going to do that refactoring because it's tedious versus, you know, I am going to do it, you know, because it's just a quick key binding, then I'm going to fire up RubyMine and I'm going to do the refactoring in RubyMine where it, you know, can be done quickly because it's more important that I keep my code refactored than that I, you know, hew to some kind of editor religion.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. I mean, if you listen to everybody on this podcast, most of us have used multiple editors and admit that we yep. do that in different situations. You know, even being a TextMate guy or, you know, whatever. When I log into a server, I use VI. You know, that's what I use, you know. So. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
When I edit code on my phone, I use Vim because my phone does not have an alt key.
That's awesome.
Good point. All right. Now we really do need to get to the picks.
Wait,
I think we're solidly at an hour now.
Okay, so I have one very quick story which will make everyone cringe, but I think it's funny and it's relevant to Ruby, which is that I went to Lone Star RubyConf in 2008 and we were going around the table in the green room and Matt's was the guest of honor. It's actually where I met James for the first time, and we were having lunch and we were talking about what editors we use. Oh, and by the way, Matt's uses Emacs. Anyway, gotta get that little plug in. And I mentioned that I use the Dvorak keyboard layout. And Matt's just kind of paused with his fork halfway to his mouth and he looked at me and he's like, but all the keys are in different places. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, how do you use Emacs? Do you map the keys to where they are on the QWERTY keyboard? I'm like, no. I just go where the keys are in the new place. And I happen to have a Bluetooth keyboard in my backpack, and on the Apple keyboards you can pop the key tops off really easily. So I had popped them all off and rearranged them in the Dvorak layout, and I handed this Bluetooth keyboard, and he took it like I was handing him a snake, and he's looking at this, and I can just see in his mind he's trying to figure out, how do I do Control X, Control S, how do I do Control X, Control F, right? And he looked at this. And he looked up to me and he said, I'll never forget this. He said, and I quote, he just made this little inarticulate cry of dismay. And then he handed the keyboard back to me. So that's my story. Anyway.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Dave. Picks. Let's start with Avdi.
So let's see. Picks today. Apropos the topic at hand, I think I'll pick Emacs Wiki. It's a wiki about Emacs, and it is a large wiki full of Emacs information. And usually if you have some question about how do I get better expansion or something like that, you can usually search Emacs Wiki and find what you're looking for. And less programming related, I did something which I rarely have time to do recently. I read and finished a novel, and it was American Gods by Neil Gaiman, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I recommend that novel for the like three people that haven't read it yet.
I haven't read that in a long time. It was good, but you're not pronouncing his name correctly.
Oh, sorry. And I know he's listening. So what is the correct pronunciation?
Neil Gaiman.
Gaiman. Okay.
Yes.
One of the great things about Neil Gaiman books is to get the audiobooks, where he typically reads them himself, and they are fantastic.
I know. He's great at that.
All right. Josh, what are your picks?
I got one pick this week, and it's an actual physical object. It's the Jawbone Jambox. And it's just a cute little box that's like, the size of a couple iPhones stacked up, something like that. And it's a remote speaker that you can hook up to your iPhone or, whatever little music player device you have. It actually is more than just a speaker for your iPhone. It will be a speaker phone for your iPhone, which is pretty cool. I got it so I can listen to music when, I'm taking a shower in the bathroom or whatever. And I don't have like my stereo in there. So it's great to be able to rock out in the morning or anywhere in the park or something. I can bring music. So, and have it amplified. And it's like $200. So it's not a impulse buy for most people, but I've been enjoying it. The one drawback with it is that apparently all of the Apple iTunes and Bluetooth software just really don't work well with how the Jambox is set up. So a lot of people are complaining online about having problems using it hooked up to their Mac. But if you're just using it with your iPod or your iPhone or whatever other kind of phone you have, it's really great, and I like the sound quality, and it's they put a lot of design sense into it, so it's a really nice device to use. So I've been enjoying that a lot.
All right, cool. Dave, what are your picks?
Three ones real quick. Two of them about Emacs, so they're apropos, and one of them that is just flat awesome. The first one is EL4R, which is it's a thingy for Emacs, whatever Emacs calls its thingies. It's a thingy for Emacs that lets you script Emacs in Ruby instead of scripting it from Emacs Lisp. So it basically gives you access to the Lisp API and all of the hooks and all the method calls. You know how like in JRuby you can do require Java and you can just start calling, you know, you can start loading jar files and calling Java things. EL4R gives you the ability to write Ruby scripts that control Emacs. I still just do everything in Emacs Lisp because I found that I ended up with EL4R. I still needed to know the full Lisp API, and so I just figured I'd bite the bullet and just learn Emacs Lisp. But if you are holding out on going to Emacs because you don't want to learn Emacs Lisp, take a look at EL4R. It lets you do everything in Ruby. The second thing is YA Snippet, which is yet another snippet program, which will basically give you TextMate like snippet expansion. You save a file called DEF under text mode, you know, snippet slash text slash Ruby, and now you put in the contents of the file, and then whenever you type def and hit tab, it will inject the contents of that file into your thing. So it's like basically TextMate snippet expansion. And then the third thing, which is just flat awesome, is I found the other day that if you go to the official Portal 2 website, which is thinkwithportals.com/music.php, you can get the complete Portal 2 soundtrack, all three CDs. They've got ringtones. They've got all of the sound, all the music from the game. The music is so good as coding tunes, and I've been listening to it while I'm programming, that I have had an irresistible urge at the end of the day to fire up Portal 2 and play some more of it. And I just actually finished Portal 2 last night at midnight again for about the 19th time, because I had to, because I'd been listening to the music because it's so great.
All right. James, what are your picks?
I've got a couple. I mentioned recently that we're going to go to RubyConf and talk there, and I recommended that people check out that conference. And I'm only planning to probably attend one other conference this year, and that's Aloha RubyConf, which is going to be in Hawaii, which is obviously the reason I want to attend it. But it looks like a great conference, and they have their registration and their call for speakers up now. So if you think that that would be a fun place to go, that you might want to look into that. The other things I wanted to recommend, more techie. I mentioned that I love TMUX, and I really do. If you want to see the coolest TMUX thing ever, then you absolutely need to look at the new integration they did with iTerm 2 and TMUX. I know I mentioned iTerm 2 in the past, and that's absolutely the best terminal on the Mac, hands down. And they now have integration where when you do things like split a window in iTerm 2, that actually sends the TMUX command and splits the window in TMUX. And so basically it maintains this TMUX session using the normal things that you do in iTerm. And it's just absolutely amazing. That's some of the coolest hacking I've seen in a long time, in my opinion. So you should check that out. And then we've talked a lot about shells and Unix integration and the various aspects of that. It occurs to me I never recommended the book that actually taught me the shell. And that book is From Bash to Z Shell. It's a really good book that walks you through Bash and what it is, and then goes into Z Shell and basically what it does differently. So it's kind of a great way to learn both at the same time and what their strengths are. And, you know, then you can decide, you know, which one is better for you after having evaluated them. And it teaches you lots of great stuff. I learned how to, you know, write shell loops and do process management and stuff like that from this book. So if you aren't up on your shell and you want to get caught up, it's like one-stop shopping for that. So those are my picks.
Cool. Gary, what are your picks?
I have two. The first is apropos of two of the four people before me using the word apropos. Emacs, MetaX apropos. Just go into Emacs, type Emacs return at your shell, type escape X apropos enter, and then some word like a window, and just see what happens. And that will in one fell swoop show you the power of Emacs that you're missing if you're not an Emacs user. And the other one is totally unrelated to editors, but Test Rocket by Peter Cooper. which is one of the most adorable pieces of Ruby code I've ever seen in my life. Just Google Test Rocket and look at the examples and then look at the implementation. And that is it.
All right. My picks this week, first off, I started exercising again. I actually entered a weight loss contest, and so that means I have to start going back to the gym and doing all that stuff to be healthy and, you know. So I went out and I bought this Speedo Aquabeat, which is an MP3 player that is waterproof and has headphones that are waterproof. And I bought a swim cap so that they'll stay in my ears, because that was a problem that I had with them. But they sound really good. And so, you know, I can get in the pool and I can swim. Not nearly as far as I would like to in a half hour, but I can swim a decent distance, and the music or whatever I'm listening to, you know, just kind of helps me find a rhythm and swim and do that kind of stuff. So that's one thing that I've really been picking up. My other pick, and this is something that I've been learning a little bit more about, is the Chrome debugger for JavaScript. It's really kind of a super handy tool. It gives you a lot of information about what's going on. Sorry, I have a little bit of a cold. But it'll break down. It'll give you a stack trace and stuff like that. And, you know, you can also fiddle with styles and you know, you can mess with your JavaScript on the fly. So those are my picks. They're just things that kind of made my life a little bit better over last week. So
Chuck, I have this image of you consuming your podcasts while swimming. And yeah, until you build up your stamina, stick to Grammar Girl and writing excuses. Don't try to listen. Don't try to listen to like Ruby Rogues or you'll drown.
Because I can't stay in the pool for an hour. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I used to be on the swim team in high school, and it's kind of funny because my form is really good and I'm really out of shape, which means that I am swimming in such a way to where I should be able to take advantage of all of the water resistance that I'm pushing against, but I'm so out of shape that it wears me out really, really fast. So anyway, kind of interesting. Real quickly to wrap this up, I did neglect to mention our sponsor. We're sponsored by New Relic, so go check them out. They got a really cool tool. You can check them out at newrelic.com. Also, we will be reading on the 22nd of this month, Land of Lisp. So if you haven't gone and bought it, go and buy it. We did get a discount code, and I don't remember what it is off the top of my head.
Ruby Rogues.
And you have to buy it at the publisher site, which is, I don't remember. Anyway, I'll put the information.
Ruby Rogues, where we are so together, you can't believe it.
Yeah.
It's you can't just buy it from landoflist.com?
Maybe you can.
Okay.
But anyway, so yeah, you can buy it. Let me see.
We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, nostarch.com. If you go to nostarch.com and use the promo code Ruby Rogues, you get 30% off the book. It's good through the end of July, so after we've read it too. But yeah, we're going to have Conrad on, and we're going to talk about it and have a good discussion about it. So looking forward to that. Other than that, we are on iTunes, so go and leave us a review. I want to thank Gary again for coming onto the podcast.
Yes.
Catch you next week.
Of course.